All right, we are in the first lesson in the book on grace. If you do not have one of these, if you would please raise your hand, and if you don't, I'm going to ask Galen. There's some should be out there still in the foyer or somebody. Rob's going to go out there and grab some. If you don't have one, please raise your hand, and we'll make sure to get one in your hand. That's the lesson book that we will be going through all quarter. All right, so I cover everybody. We still have extra books, so we'll continue to pass those out through the quarter. But I would, since we had to purchase these books, I would ask you to not get into the habit of taking one home and then forgetting one and using one in class and taking it home and forgetting it and use not repeatedly anyway. So if you do forget yours, we certainly should have some in the classroom, but we want to at least make sure we've got some whenever visitors come and join us in the class as well. Grace, God's power to overcome sin, is the actual lesson. All right, let's begin with a prayer. Father, we're so grateful for the day, for its blessings, for your love and for your kindness, for every wonderful thing that we have. We give you thanks. We pray that you would accept our thanks and that you would bless us as we seek to better understand your word, as we seek to grow in our relationship, draw closer to you, so that we may be better able to maintain the kind of faith that we need to continue to have a strong relationship with you in this life, so that we can have an eternal relationship with you when this life is over. That is our goal, that we might live a life that would display the faith in your wonderful gift that you have provided to us through your Son. Please accept our thanks in Jesus' name. Amen. All right, I'm going to ask you to do something real quickly. If you have a cell phone or an iPad or something like that, we're probably going to begin each class or most classes with this little poll. And rather than ask you to raise your hand, if you'll go to that website that's listed right there at the bottom, pollev.com, /Mark Broyles 265. It's going to pop up that four-question poll. All you have to do is hit one of the letters, and it's real-time recording of that. So, and without recording your name or your phone number, it doesn't give me any of that information at all. It just records the poll results, and it gives us a chance to kind of look at that and see whether or not that changes as we go through the quarter. And because it's a poll that does not ask you for any of your personal information, I would encourage you to answer that absolutely, completely, honestly, and it will give us a chance to kind of deal with those things as we go through this quarter, talking about grace. And part of the reason for that is that this class, as was mentioned last week probably, I'm sure Rob did as he dealt with the class, that this class, a couple of things that are critical to keep in mind for the class to go the way it's supposed to. One, we are not going to cover all there is to cover on grace in this quarter. The class is not intended to do that. It deals with some major concepts on grace, and we intend to cover those. Secondly, we're going to cover those concepts one lesson at a time. Sometimes when we introduce the subject of grace, it immediately just kind of goes into a scatter mode and goes all kinds of different directions. And there's reasons for that. We'll talk a little bit about that still this evening as well. And so what we want to do is stay confined, and that's going to be maybe even harder in lesson one than in some of the other lessons, because lesson one doesn't mention grace at all. So we're in a study on grace, but we're really not going to be dealing with grace specifically, even though we'll mention that, but the lesson does not direct itself specifically at that. Each one of these lessons, I don't know if Rob got a chance to mention this last week, I forgot to ask him this part, but each one of these lessons has a case study in the beginning. Sometimes we're good with that, sometimes we're not overly fond of doing case studies, but they're just intended, each case study, to make a simple point. They are all fictional case studies, but based on real concepts. And so as you see the case studies, and you see people that are involved in discussions in the case studies, then it could certainly be very real, as we'll see tonight. So we'll read through that. And if you want to also open your Bibles to Romans chapter 7, that will be the text for the most part that we will be using tonight as we try to understand this first lesson regarding how it is that we're going to accomplish the understanding of grace that provides us an opportunity to overcome sin, as the lesson indicates. And so, and I appreciate those that are putting that on. Results are coming up in real time here very quickly. And as I was, I was hoping, but I don't know that hoping is the right word to use here, but as I was expecting, it's not the kind of question that is just absolutely everybody answering the same way. Depending on what's going on in our lives, how we feel, where we are, we wrestle with that question a little bit when we talk about grace. And so as they're coming in, and I'll wait a few more minutes, and I'll just kind of give you the results, and so you can see how that question is being answered and why a class like this, I think, is especially beneficial. We rarely study grace for any length of time. We'll have lessons on grace, but again, that's normally very directed or very specific at certain concepts, and especially dealing with certain concepts that we feel we have to deal with regarding grace. Why would we ever feel like there are things we have to deal with on grace? Yeah, it's a subject that is greatly misunderstood. And so sometimes it's difficult to just stay within the framework or the context of a single point, because we understand the world, and the religious world has a lot of misunderstandings about grace. And so we want to make sure sometimes that people don't go the wrong direction, so we immediately kind of leap off in that direction. So we're going to look at these one at a time. So I'm going to ask you to kind of stay with me on that, or if you get a little off point, I'll probably try to bring it back to being on point, and we'll just do the one lesson at a time. So in other words, each lesson has a single purpose, something that we hope that we can walk away from the class having a full understanding or knowledge of, but it may only be a single point, and it may not be a point that in and of itself solves anything. It's just that we did gain something knowledge-wise. So look at this case. How many people got a chance to read the case study ahead of time? All right, so we'll go ahead and read through it. That was about half the group raised their hand. I would ask you, just to save time in class, since you'll have the books, read the case studies ahead of time. It'll just prevent us from having to read them in the class. Peter Johnson was struggling. He had come to see the preacher, Paul Evans. Don't you like that he starts with Peter and Paul? So he said, to figure out exactly what he should be doing. Peter started, "Paul, I just don't know what to do. I read my Bible every day. I pray regularly. I go to church every time the doors are open. I don't ever beat my wife. I've never cheated on her. I'm trying to do everything right so that God will let me go to heaven, but I just keep struggling. It seems that no matter how hard I try, I just have an awful temper. I blow up at the kids. I yell at my wife. When I get mad, I just can't control myself. Last night, I told myself on the way home from work that I was going to keep my cool. I prayed in the driveway. I even memorized Ephesians 4:26, which is going to talk about the anger, or having anger but not sinning, while I was sitting there. But I walked in the house. It was a mess. The kids were running around and yelling. My wife didn't have dinner ready. The first thing she did was hand me the baby and tell me to change his diaper. I lost it. I called her all kinds of names. I yelled at the kids. Everybody spent the whole night crying. Liz and I didn't even talk the rest of the night. We went to bed facing opposite directions. She wouldn't even look at me this morning. Why can't I stop this, Paul? I don't want to act like this, but it happens over and over." Paul was flummoxed. While he didn't struggle with his temper, Peter's story sounded a lot like Paul's struggle with materialism and debt. He knew that what he should really say is, "Peter, I don't have any idea how to help you on this one. I still struggle with sins I don't want to do any more than you do. We both need to find someone else who knows what to do." Instead, Paul actually said, "That sounds awful, Peter. I can really relate. I think you're working on the right path with the prayer and Bible reading. Maybe you just need to do more. Maybe if you read your Bible with your wife and had Bible study with your family, every day you could be strong enough to overcome this sin. You know, sin is a choice and you need to choose better. I know you can do it, just try harder. Peter left with renewed determination to try harder, but just wasn't sure how much harder he could try. He was trying pretty hard. Paul left thinking, I don't know why I told him that. I say that to myself every time, and it doesn't work for me. Why would it work for him? So, as you start to look at that, and let me just give you a count, because most of these will probably be in. I have complete confidence of the results that came in. 6, I am working hard and hopeful. 4, I am doubtful some days. 5, I worry often because I feel in and out. 4. So I'm saying pretty across the board on those responses. And that's helpful because there's something that God would want us to understand, I think, about his grace. And about what grace does and what grace can do. And this particular class is called Grace, God's Power to Overcome Sin. So how is it that we are going to get ourselves, if we can, into a little different mode? So as you think about the nature, and I don't think I have a, let me see what happens. Oh, it does go black. I didn't have a black slide, so I thought, I don't know what I'm going to see up there. As we struggle, may or may not be a temper issue at all. Somebody in here may have a temper issue. Somebody, have you known anybody that struggles with a temper issue? Difficult to overcome? What about other issues? I mean, if your issue is not temper, temper, Paul said in this, not Paul the Apostle, that's the danger of having Peter and Paul in the case study. Paul in the case study said that, that's not my issue. My issue is materialism and debt. But I struggle with it just the same. How many of you in here would say that you've had some particular thing that you've worked on in your life that you have decided I'm going to do better at that and committed to do better at that only to find yourself tripping up and falling in the same area again? You ever had that? Yeah, no question. These aren't unusual cases. Would you agree with that? That it could be any number of things that could be the temptation that is causing us to trip up. There is a couples counseling study that we use with some couples that are really struggling with some things that deal with what the guy that put this together, what he calls generational sins, not inherited. He doesn't believe, nor do I, that you inherit sin from your parents or anybody else down the line, but you do learn behavior from your parents and others down the line. So he calls them generational sins. In other words, things that you have find yourself struggling with that somebody else in your family also struggles with. In other words, you've got a learned behavior. If that's what you've done, you've got a learned behavior that you've pulled along and you're struggling with it, but you probably learned it in-house somewhere. Parents, grandparents, aunt, uncle, something of that sort. But then he deals with, after you deal with those issues, he deals with what he calls strongholds. And strongholds may be some of the generational issues. But he just says, almost, in his opinion, almost every Christian battles strongholds. In other words, there are some things, like I would give you an example. In my household, alcoholism and drunkenness and that kind of thing was a huge problem in my household. I have zero struggle with that. I don't know if it was because of the hatred toward what it produced. There are multiple factors, but I'm saying you could set down whatever you wanted in front of me to offer me a drink of alcoholic beverage, and that's not going to cause me an issue at all. But there are other issues that I have struggled with that are not the same. I can't say there's no struggle there. It seems that Satan understands where our weaknesses are, and he kind of repeats that over and over. He knows where we can trip up, and there are things that are kind of a stronghold against us. And that's kind of what this idea is about, that we fight it, not everything across the board. This lesson is not about that you cannot have better behavior after coming to Christ than you did before. This lesson is about recognizing some things about as individuals, our problems and the things that we struggle with. So what kind of advice would you or would you normally hear offered to somebody in this man's position? Peter comes to you with these anger issues. What kinds of things would we normally advise him, or do you think would be given to him by way of advice? Oh, Karen? I think clearly we would talk about spending more time in prayer. Marla? Yeah, absolutely. So we talk about changing his behavior. Is he doing anything corrective about the responses that he's had? And that apology may require much more than just words, we understand. So we advise him to apologize. Yeah, David? Yeah, and it doesn't say. You know, the idea of the lesson is, and I think of the case study, is just to indicate for Christians, one of the first things that we have to recognize is that we can struggle mightily with some different problems, different kinds of issues. And so if you look at Romans chapter 7, we want to read verses 7 through 24. Let's go ahead and read, which is kind of an odd, even though, as we've mentioned before, the chapters are artificially inserted anyway, but we're going to stop one verse before the end of the chapter in this reading. So Paul's talking. Now, he's just talked about the idea. He has talked about grace in the previous chapter, and we'll come back to what he says in chapter 6 in a moment. But he says in chapter 7, what shall we say then? Is the law sin? Certainly not. On the contrary, I would not have known sin except through the law, for I would not have known covetousness unless the law said, you shall not covet. But sin, taking opportunity by the commandment, produced in me all manner of evil desire, for apart from the law, sin was dead. I was alive once without the law, but when the commandment came, sin revived and I died. And the commandment, which was to bring life, I found to bring death. For sin, taking occasion by the commandment, deceived me, and by it killed me. Therefore, the law is holy, and the commandment is holy and just and good. So then he's going to ask more questions. Has then what is good become death to me? Certainly not. But sin, that it might appear sin, was producing death in me through what is good, so that sin through the commandment might become exceedingly sinful. For we know that the law is spiritual, but I am carnal, sold under sin. For what I am doing, I do not understand. For what I will do, that I do not practice. But what I hate, that I do. If then I do what I will not to do, I agree with the law that it is good. But now it is no longer I who do it, but sin that dwells in me. For I know that in me, that is in my flesh, nothing good dwells. For to will is present with me, but how to perform what is good I do not find. For the good that I will to do, I do not do. But the evil I will not to do, that I practice. That whole section was in a Paul's Tongue Twisters sermon that a friend of ours did. And so he says, for I delight in the law of God. Oh, let me get back up. I skipped a verse, didn't I? I find then a law in verse 21 that is that evil is present with me, the one who wills to do good. For I delight in the law of God according to the inward man. But I see another law in my members, warring against the law of my mind and bringing me into captivity to the law of sin, which is in my members. Oh, wretched man that I am, who will deliver me from this body of death? So we're going to just stop right there for this lesson and talk a little bit about that. So typically, if you're thinking in terms of Paul, the Apostle Paul now, if you're thinking in terms of the Apostle Paul, and somebody says, describe to me the Apostle Paul's life spiritually, the Apostle Paul's strength spiritually, how would you normally define that? Yeah, I mean, normally you'd say this is a man that has an incredibly strong life spiritually. Would this passage make you think that that was not true? Okay, there you go. It is a yes and no kind of thing, isn't it? It's not that Paul is saying, I'm therefore not still a spiritual person. Paul, on another occasion, speaks of himself as being spiritually mature, does he not? When he's talking to the Philippians, one of his points is that some people are not as spiritually mature, and he says, but those of us who are perfect or mature, the word he uses there, and he talks about the obligation we have to those who are not. And so Paul was willing to acknowledge that he was spiritually strong. That's not the only thing he's dealing with here. Yeah, absolutely. So, which is interesting because we're not going to go off on this track because it's really not pertinent to this lesson. But sometimes people get wrapped up in chapter 7 is Paul talking about before he became a Christian, after he became a Christian. The statement about living in clear conscience was talking about before becoming a Christian. So, wouldn't make any difference whether Paul was talking about before or after. Either time he was trying to live a life that was pleasing to God. Would you agree with that? I mean, it wasn't under the cross of Christ, but he was still trying to live. Some believe that it's very theoretical. Paul's using a theoretical. But somebody turn to 1 Corinthians chapter 3. Let's assume Paul wasn't even speaking about himself. I think he is. I think he's clearly talking about himself. 1 Corinthians chapter 3. Is he, Lance, you there already? Look, read verses 1 through 3, if you would. All right, so Paul says, as he's writing to the Corinthians, he says, I'd like to write to you guys on a different level than I am, but I can't. You're still carnally minded. You're still very fleshly in your thinking. So it would be easy sometimes to think, well, yeah, these Corinthians were just, they were just awful people, weren't they? I mean, you read through these chapters, and there's just one thing after another that Paul's saying. They couldn't get along with one another. They fight over spiritual gifts. They have got the whole marriage picture all confused. There's all kinds of issues. Somebody go to chapter 1 and read verses 4 and 5. Mason, you read that for us? So who are these people? What's that? It is complicated. Are they Christians first? These are Christians. There's no question about that. Are they Christians that are as strong as they should be, do you think? Don't think so. Paul was saying, I wish I could write to you in a different manner. He wished they had grown more than they had grown. But they are Christians nonetheless, and he said their lives had changed, at least to some level, with the reception of the grace of God and the grace of Christ, which is true of any Christians. The idea is Christians can struggle mightily with sinful behavior. True? That's an issue. And sometimes there are reasons for that are a little different than what we may think they are. As you think about these guys in this story, both of them have this idea, and I'm telling you, I'm assuming some of you, if not all of you, have been there. I have been there where I have said, I've got to get a better grip on this. You know what? I've got to double down, work harder. If it requires more reading, if it requires more praying, if it requires whatever means I'm trying to put in place by way of accountability, other people saying things to me. But there's a mentality sometimes that I've got to buckle down and really work on this problem. Would you agree with that? And yet, there have been times where I've, with that attitude absolutely in place, you find yourself doing it again, even though you're trying to double down. And I'll just give you a personal example. So hopefully the personal examples don't cause me to lose my opportunity to teach or anything as we work our way through the class. I've mentioned before, the home I grew up in was completely dysfunctional. very abusive. Screaming and yelling was the normal tone that was going on, at least from one side of the family. I don't remember my mom ever being that person that was screaming back. But there was lots of that going on. And yelling, most of the conversations that I ever had with my father weren't really conversations. They were him yelling something at me or yelling something at my brothers or my sister. And so I had determined pretty early on, I am not going to raise my voice at my children. So there you go. I had this great commitment, was not going to do it. And what do you think happened? Raised my voice at my children. And so I said, you know what? That's not going to happen again. I'm doubling down the effort. It's not going to happen again. And what do you think happened? Raise my voice at the children. You know, whatever the case is, and the issue that I struggle with for me, the issues that I struggle with, temper is not normally one of them. I'm much more of a clam up than a blow up if I'm going to choose one of the two of those. And so the temper wasn't the thing that I struggled with. But you do find out that you kind of get this double down mentality, and yet it's extremely difficult. So when you look at Paul, Paul was a mature Christian. Paul was a spiritual man. You couldn't possibly, I don't think, read chapter 7 even of Romans and say Paul was not a spiritual man, that he wasn't a man who was trying to follow God. I think Paul's coming to recognition of some things, and especially some things having come out of the law and into Jesus Christ, things that he had to get a different perception on regarding those kinds of things. Because the issue with the law was what? What was the real issue with the law? Yeah, it wasn't perfect. It wasn't complete. It was temporary. And so the law said you can't be pleasing to God if you, and then it would give you a whole list of things, correct? The Ten Commandments and a list of a bunch of other things. And the law, the point that is made later is, if you're guilty in how much of the law, what's God interested in? Any point. Isn't that what he said? If you're guilty in any point, you're guilty in all, in the sense of you're guilty of breaking the law. It is a one package kind of deal. And so you can't say, I did, when Jesus had some discussions with some people occasionally, wasn't it, you know, it was people saying, hey, I did this, and I did this, and I did this, and I did. And so Jesus said something simple like, you know, well, sell everything you got and give it to the poor. You wrestle a little harder with what it takes to follow him, but it wouldn't matter. Even if you could say, I never killed anybody, I never committed adultery, I never stole anything from anybody, and you start saying, look at all these laws, I held these all the way to perfection. The point is, all the law is going to prove to you is at some point that's not going to happen, right? At some point, there's going to be a falling short, and now you're done. Because the problem with the law was, law provided no way to correct that permanently, did it? Law identified the sin. It didn't provide a way to eliminate it. And so Paul's going to be talking about this whole mentality that would come along easily for Jews in the law as far as what they are trying to do. So what is it that Paul is struggling with? What are the things he says that you can either relate to or you find difficulty with? What is it that he's struggling with? How is he describing this in here? What's that? Oh, I'm sorry, Paul the Apostle. In Romans 7. Yeah, I mean, you read something like that from Paul when he says, but I'm carnal. He says, we know the law is good. It's spiritual, he says in verse 14, but I'm carnal, sold under sin. For what I'm doing, I do not understand. You ever been there? I don't even know why I did that. I don't even know why I said that. What is the issue here? Then he says, for what I will to do or what I want to do, he says, that I don't do. I don't practice that. But what I hate, I do. So what is Paul saying is going on? What is he recognizing about himself when you're looking at this? Because we know he's going to draw some conclusions, but all we want to do is get the recognition that Paul's recognizing. Does he want to do what's right? Would you say that Paul wants to do what's right? I mean, that's what he says when you start in verse 18, doesn't he? and all the way down really through verse 22, but he says, "For I know that in me, that is in my flesh, nothing good dwells, for to will is present with me." He says, I want to do what's right. That's present inside of me. The will is there. So where's the struggle? What's he going through? What are we going through? Sometimes the physical body. What'd you say? Yeah, absolutely. It's called life. Paul is recognizing something about just having to live in this body and in this world. Ben? Which is going to be a great point in this lesson, is understanding what the opposing forces are here in regards to how Satan is working. How is he described, Satan? What's that? Yeah, as a roaring lion. He is seeking whom he may devour and being pretty successful many times. Would you agree with that? He's a deceiver as well. He is going to make things look different than they are. He's going to play on our minds as far as what is offered to us. You know, I mentioned that that's not my particular struggle, alcohol, but I dealt with a guy in Kansas City who battled that mightily, and I've watched several who battle with alcoholism and drunkenness and that kind of things, and there's great deceit involved with that entire industry. Would you agree with that? I remember one of my favorite celebrities, a sports figure years ago that I had never really seen doing anything to promote anything. Doesn't mean he wasn't doing it, but I had never seen him. Then he came on with a commercial, and he said, "Coors is my beer." I just thought, you realize how many people, how many young people, young kids saw that commercial and were thinking there was something of redeeming value in Coors because it was this man's beer and that association. There's such deceit that Satan uses to trick us into those kinds of things. Other ways that he's described. He's the accuser. You know, when you get to that great passage in the Old Testament where he's accusing before Israel, before God, and you've got that whole discussion with the appearance of Joshua, the high priest, and that's with God and Zechariah there, and you get all of that that's going on. Great accusation made, and I love what one author said when he's talking to us about God, he whispers, but when he's talking to God about us, he yells. Why? Because he's got the truth. So he can take the truth before God and talk about how dirty we really are, that kind of thing. And he does that. And then he's also called the ruler. Why is that helpful? To understand that he's the ruler of this world. He has got power, doesn't he? And that's kind of what this lesson is about. What am I going to recognize? Because we understand he doesn't have the power of God. First John says, greater is he that is in you than is in the world. But if you were comparing Satan and you, who's got more power? He wields more power in this world than we do. And so it becomes critical that we understand that whole power struggle. Paul is trying to live the right way. I think a key point, if you turn back to chapter 6 for just a moment, Paul has said in chapter 6, you've got to have a right understanding of the nature of grace to begin with, what it's even for. I had never met anybody that had openly taken the opposite position as Paul in this verse until just in the last couple of years. several people that were openly taking the other side of this debate, which was pretty amazing to me. And I'll explain that in a minute. But he says, what shall we say then? Shall we continue in sin that grace may abound? Certainly not. How shall we who died to sin any longer live in it? So why the question? He says, so what? What should we say? Because he's just talked about the incredible grace of God. So what do we say? Grace. Grace is so great that we should continue sinning? I mean, that seems completely illogical to us anyway, wouldn't you say? Give me a practical example of that kind of thing happening. Because, again, just to bring a thing into the equation, some young people that are Christians who were getting heavily involved in drinking and things of that nature, and getting drunk, going out to parties, getting drunk, their response was not, you know what, that was a moment of weakness. Their response was, we know the grace of God will cover this. That's a complete misunderstanding of the whole purpose. Paul is saying grace is not permissive, but there's a danger that it can be taken that way. Why? Give me a practical example that sometimes permission is seen where permission is not really given. Does that make sense? And if it doesn't, if that's too ambiguous, then I'll give you an example in a moment. Yeah, children will take silence as an approval. And I was thinking of a children example because it doesn't even have to be silence. But they will definitely take that as approval many times and think, oh, well, that worked, and so I'll do that again. Children, but I remember making a statement to our kids, which you don't necessarily think when you make it that it's as fraught with danger as it is. But sitting your children down and saying to one of them or all of them, look, I want you to understand, I know you're going to make mistakes. I know that. I know you're going to make mistakes. And so it's not the end of the world when you make a mistake. It's what we do with the mistake. But when you're telling a child, I know you're going to make mistakes, what might the child think? What's that? Yeah, it opens the door. I don't have to try so hard. Dad already knows I'm going to make a mistake. He's going to be okay with that. And so you never intended permissiveness by the statement. You were trying to talk about this relationship that we have and why it's important for them to come back to you, even if they make the mistakes, that kind of thing. But a child may take that the wrong way. And so just to talk about the nature of grace, but Paul is not looking for permission to sin. Paul is stating as openly and honestly as he can, I don't want to live this way. I don't want to sin. I want to do what's right before God. But then he calls himself what? I'm sorry, what? The chiefest of sinners on one occasion? I'll tell you the thing that bothers me the most about that statement. Because I always think, all right, so let's just categorize people. We shouldn't categorize people. I'm not suggesting you do that. And so if I say, so here's Paul. He's the chiefest of sinners. Where do I get to put myself on the list where Paul is the chiefest of sinners? I'm thinking, this is not good for me. You know, as I look at Paul's life and he addresses himself that way. In this passage, how does he address himself? In chapter 7. Oh, wretched man that I am. You ever have any of God's other people make statements that are similar to that? Can you think of? About Isaiah chapter 6. You remember that whole discussion? King Uzziah dies and Isaiah is just all distraught over that. And then what happens? And why did he say that? Because he was feeling sad, but he wasn't necessarily focused on himself only at that point.
He was separated from God.
All right. Because he saw God in his majesty. And he recognized who he was. He saw that distance, didn't he? If this is God, I'm way down here. So he says, you know, I'm a man of unclean lips. God's going to correct that for him in Isaiah 6, which we'll get into one of the other lessons if the Lord permits us to. But he recognizes his sinfulness because of the presence of God. And he understands that there's not anything I can do about this. Paul is saying, to me anyway, he's saying, I can't do anything about this. I want to not sin, but I can't not sin. He's not saying that across the board. He's saying, based on this method, similar to what these two guys in this story had, the pull yourself up by your bootstraps. That God needs us to recognize our absolute poverty of spirit. And so he starts off the whole description of the Beatitudes by what? What is going to be the most critical thing, even for the rest to be built on? I think he put those in an order that he put them in for a reason. He's saying the absolute first thing you have to recognize is what? The poverty of spirit, who you are. How critical is that? You remember Jesus having a discussion with a Pharisee in his house about, so who's the greater of the sinner? That wasn't really the issue, was it? Anybody going to make an appeal before God and say, I'm less of a sinner than that person, and therefore I should attain eternal life? And that's not going to get you in, is it? The point is, sin is sin. Sin is filthy. The point he was making to this Pharisee is what? You don't recognize who you are. You're pointing at who she is. You don't recognize who you are. And I think to understand the subject of grace, because grace that he's talking about in these lessons that we're going to be looking at is not just the generic gift of Jesus to the world, where he's the propitiation for sins for the whole world, as John says in 1 John. He's going to be talking about his people. We're talking about how does grace help me overcome sin. Look at a couple of other passages here, if you would, real quickly. Matthew chapter 26. Who's there? Christy, are you there? Would you read verse 25 first? Verse 35 first, and then verse 41 after that. All right, so stop there for just a second. So there's Peter. We know the outcome of that, don't we? Peter did what? Wonderfully well at that commitment? Not so well. He denied the Lord. But he had, do you think Peter didn't mean what he said? And I think Peter meant what he said. I think Peter was stepping up and saying, I don't care what it takes, I'm going to follow you. And if they kill me, they kill me. Don't you think that's what Peter's saying? I don't care. Whatever happens, happens. But he didn't do that. And then you get to the garden and read verse 41. All right, so the point that he's making is what? He's saying, I'm telling you, in your mind, you may have it all worked out. I'm not going to do it. And that's what I did. I will not raise my voice again. The mind and the spirit were willing. That was absolutely what I wanted to do. The next time I raised my voice to my children was not because I had changed my mind and said, you know what, now I want to yell at them. I'm going to change my philosophy of life. I've had enough. And so now, from now on, I want to yell at them. It wasn't. It was that the mind was still there, but the flesh was weak. They did something that in my mind tripped some kind of behavior or action and caused me to do something. I'm confident that as you're making those statements, there wasn't a part of me saying in the back of my mind, while I'm making it, you're completely unjustified in all that you're saying right now, but say it anyway. It's not till after I've said it that it comes to me and I realize, I did it again. I didn't want to do that. I did it again. And that's the point of this first lesson, is recognizing that we are not inherently depraved. As a matter of fact, in Ephesians, when in chapter 2 and verses 1 and 3, it talks about being dead in sins. Being dead infers what? Or implies what? We have to infer. Being dead implies what? Separated from God is what he's going to be talking about. You were alive once. You can't be dead if you were never alive. And I think within that passage even is the idea. You were dead in your trespasses. It was your sin. You started out alive. We're formed in the image of God, deformed by sin, transformed by God later. But there's that period in between, and that's what he's saying. So it's not an inherited depravity, but what he's saying is because we invited sin into our lives, sin has a tendency to grab a hold. And that's what Paul seems to be saying. He's saying it gets control. I'm allowing the sin sometimes to direct my life. And so I've got to recognize that I'm a wretched man in that sense, even when I'm trying to live spiritually. I'm a wretched man before God because that's what makes us available for lesson two. There's good news. But I think that it's critical that we recognize our own sinfulness and our own struggles with sin and what a difficult time we have if we're going to have the avenue ready to accept the grace of God and understand what it really is for and what it does. Once I recognize who I am more equipped to receive what God has to share with me. Does that make sense? And so the first lesson is, as much as you want. We went and saw that guy that had the alcoholism problem on one occasion, and the friend that went with me, you ever have somebody go with you on an appointment and all you can think about afterwards is, sure wish I hadn't have taken him. He told this guy that's struggling with alcoholism, he said, alcoholism's a choice. Just pull yourself up by your bootstraps and get on with life. There are choices, no question about that. In all that process, there are choices. And this guy had to try to do what was right. There's no question about that. But he was weak. And he recognizes, as long as you're trying to win the battle completely by yourself, what you're going to find out is that you're very ill-equipped for that, and that kind of opens us for the next lesson. Thank you guys for the attention.